When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Hey, I'm Paul Stevenson, and this is VRP Rocks, the ultimate classic rock podcast that says that my music is better than yours. Make sure to subscribe to VRP Rocks on your podcast app right now so that you don't miss a single episode. They come out each Monday and always feature big-name rock stars that found fame in the 60s, 70s, or 80s. And today's interview sees the return of an iconic rock singer, former member of Rainbow and Deep Purple, worked with Yngwie Malmsteen and Bob Daisley, Carmine Appice, Glenn Hughes, and many, many more, the wonderful Jo Lynn Turner. Now, it's the first interview, I believe, since the birth of his young son, Matteo, just under a year ago, so I was very privileged to get the chance to speak with him. I've spoken with Joe previously on VRP Rocks, all the way back on episode 14, and it's one of the most listened to episodes of the entire series. So if you haven't already, make sure you go back and check that one out. It's a real deep dive into his life and career. But today's episode, though, it's another My 5 Favourite, and I love these because it gives us a real insight into what the rock legends think of their own career. Joe will be revealing his 5 favourite albums that he has sung on. And like I said, given his role of honour, he has a lot of choice, and so you're going to get to hear brilliant stories behind the making of these records, why they mean so much to Joe, stories behind some of the songs, the band dynamics at the time, stories of, well, rock star excess and producer excess as well, making videos in the MTV era, and much, much more. It's a fascinating chat. And this week, you're also going to get a bonus episode. Lucky you, I spoke with Joe for about an hour and a half, and I put to him a lot of your questions too. So on Friday, there's going to be a special bonus episode where he goes into a lot of things, like the backlash from joining Rainbow, the decision to reveal all about his alopecia, the effect of grunge on his career, working with Yngwie, how he felt about not being asked to do the follow-up to Deep Purple's record, Slaves and Masters, how becoming a father again has changed him, and so much more. It's another cracking episode that you won't want to miss. That's coming up this Friday. And also, a quick mention, as always, for you to give VRP Rocks Radio a try. It's an online radio station 24/7 that plays deep cuts and classic hits and a lot of songs that you'd never get to hear on your kind of usual classic rock radio. So ditch them and come and listen to VRP Rocks Radio. You get a lot of bands that you never hear on your regular stuff. A lot of forgotten greats that are playing all the time. There's been some brilliant feedback so far, and I really appreciate everybody that's listened. So if you haven't yet, or if you have and forgot about it, then please go back and check out VRP Rocks Radio. There's a link in this episode description and the description to the podcast too, or you can go on the VRP Rocks Facebook and Twitter pages, and there'll be a pinned post at the top, and that'll tell you how to listen. A quick click and you'll be able to give it a try. Please do, you'll be pleasantly surprised. Right, back to Jo Lynn Turner then. Here we go as we find out the 5 albums of his that he cares for the most, with a lot of cool behind-the-scenes stories told. Please enjoy this chat with Jo Lynn Turner. It's my pleasure to welcome back Mr. Jo Lynn Turner.
Thank you, Paul. It's good to reconnect with you.
Indeed. It's nice to chat with you again, Joe. And the reason we've got you back is for a very interesting feature we've got called My 5 Favorites, where we get people to choose their 5 favorite either songs or albums that they've worked on. So what we'll do, we'll begin with number one and your first choice. And which one is it?
Rainbow, Straight Between the Eyes. And I chose that album. First of all, I think it's a great album. But to me, it's the album where we actually were finding ourselves as far as a band and as far as writers. With this new sound that Rainbow was creating. It's been told many times that Richie was looking for commercial success. He was looking for more radio-friendly material, and this is where I come in to supply that specifically. Dio, you know, the era with Dio was amazing, you know, but it was a different era that Richie wanted to keep separate from what he was doing with this Rainbow. And Straight Between the Eyes, we really came together on this is who we are, this is where we're going. And I think it worked in live situations as well as on the record. So I'd have to say Straight Between the Eyes. Death Valley Driver, Stone Cold, Bring on the Night, you know, Miss Mistreated. I mean, all these songs started to come together when we were in Canada. And for me, it just seemed like, well, we found ourselves.
Absolutely.
But compositionally, he was writing great songs, you know, Tearing Out My Heart. Come on.
Yeah, great song. Just going back to Death Valley Driver and Stone Cold, and you mentioned obviously Richie was looking for the commercial success, especially in America. So those ones were big hits, and Stone Cold was a big hit in America as well. So how did Richie react to actually getting those hits and that success?
Well, this is what he wanted. And when we started to chart with that song, I think he was just elated. He just said, we're on the right track. You know, this is exactly what we set out to do. But also not to be diminished by writing something like Eyes of Fire, which I think is one of the heavier Rainbow tracks that at least I was involved with, which showed that we could do that. You know, we could do something that long, that heavy, that epic. But at the same time, he was extremely interested. As long as we have one or two hits off the record, fine. Then we can go into stuff like that, you know.
Yeah.
Power and songs like that. But of course, Richie was very happy. It's what he wanted.
Yeah, good stuff. And just the song that you mentioned earlier, Tearing Out My Heart, I mean, that is slower, it's heavier, it's got a darker feel to it as well. So what do you remember of writing and putting that one together?
Honestly, I was in up in San Savar, right outside Montreal. We were in this in the band house, big band house. And I took a small little cabin off the lake. And because I knew there was going to be a lot of chaos going on in the big house, I would go to the big house for meals and for, you know, just hanging out with the guys. But I would always return back to my little cabin where I could sit down, light a candle and just write, because you need a certain amount of silence when you do that. And I was actually writing out Tear It On My Heart. And I started to get bombarded with like snowballs and whatever they could find, you know, just to disturb me. And it became quite funny because after a while, because we all ended up on the ice and skating and playing a little hockey and so on. But that interrupted my first draft of Tear It Out My Heart. But in a way, it was good to take that breather, return to it late at night, burn the candle, and the lyrics came out.
Fantastic. And just in terms of Rainbow and your time with the group in general, I mean, obviously you mentioned the Dio era, and it's obviously hugely successful in what it did. And then Graham came along, and then you came along, and the commercial success kind of evolved from that in America. So did you receive any backlash from fans about the way the sound changed?
Any backlash? I received nothing but backlash. No, actually, it was a lot of backlash. But I think that happens when anybody new comes into an established band, that the old guard really resents the new guard. And, you know, the old adage that people don't like change. And that's okay, because it was a completely different sound we were going for. Anyway, we were not trying to be comparative in any way. So, yes, received a lot of backlash. And I always just kept saying, we are not, you know, the Dio era. We're something else. We're more, yes, are we more commercial? Yes, we are. We want to be. That's what we want. We want to get our songs on the radio. We want to be on the MTV. That's what we want, okay? Yeah. I mean, I'll always be thankful and appreciative of Richie for giving me that opportunity and also giving me the opportunity to live up to it, giving me the freedom and the support that I needed in order to get over all of the, shall we say, flashback from the Dio era and the Bonnet era and things like that. So by believing in me and saying we're on the right track and doing the right thing, I mean, I felt very confident about what we were doing. And of course, we saw the results of that within. I mean, we charted. And we also sold more concerts, became very popular. A lot of people don't even know the earlier eras, you know, so it's very strange that way. But at the same time, MTV was coming out, the videos and so on and so forth. So I look back at Rainbow with a grateful heart. Much thanks. I mean, you know, and at the same time, a successful mission, shall we say. We did what we intended to do.
100%. Well, fantastic. First album to choose there, Joe. So let's move on to number two. And which record have you chosen as your second?
Oh, I don't know. Let's see the second. I'll choose Rescue You, which was my first solo album, okay, on Elektra Records. And it's just been nominated one of the, by Classic Rock, one of the greatest top 50 AOR albums ever. Which is great, which really is a great honor. I think I came in at number 43 or something like that. So still, you know, to be nominated like that and to be listed, I think is a great honor. And it was that. It was a fantastic album, a fantastic time for me. Roy Thomas Baker producing, you don't get better than Roy, you know, extremely a gifted producer. And I think that album sounds amazing to this day. The way he records and what he's done just sounds fresh and powerful and beats all the modern technology. And we were using analog at the time. And I think the songs on it are stellar. The writing was amazing. Al Greenwood from Foreigner, the keyboard player, he was there contributing to the writing a lot. And we had a great chemistry together. So, I mean, songs like Losing You and Young Hearts, Endlessly. You know, I mean, I can go on and on. I think the album is just chock full of great songs, great memories for me. So I had to choose it as one of my faves.
Yeah, it's not surprising at all. And we spoke, as I said previously, about your time coming to an end with Rainbow and how you felt you knew it was coming and you expected that to happen. So with this first solo record, what was your thoughts about producing this? Did you have offers from other bands or was it always going to be on the cards that you wanted to do something under your own name?
Well, I had the offer from Elektra just before Rainbow started to split up and it was kind of put on hold. So I immediately, when I knew that that was it for the band, I just said, immediately, I'll take the offer. And they actually suggested Roy Thomas Baker. And he was a very expensive producer and very celebrated producer at the time. So I just thought I was in the catbird seat, as they say, you know. And I was really looking forward to it. And the album came out great. We were up at Bearsville Studios for maybe a couple of months.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And I have to say, Elektra really supported that. When it came time to actually promote the record, though, they said they had run out of money, at least for my project, because Roy kind of went over the top and spent tons of money on everything that he had going up there. I mean, he had a private chauffeur, a private house on the mountain. He was flying in people all the time. So he was spending money like water. And to be honest with you, I was just like working on the songs and trying to keep my head straight doing the vocals. So I wasn't paying too much attention to that. But when we got on the board meeting, they all said, do you realize what you spent here? And Roy turned around and says, well, not really. And I had no idea. And when they named the figure, I was just gobstruck. I was just, oh my God, really? So it was an expensive album. Sounds great, but the promotion, I think, fell down a bit because of that.
That's a shame, a real shame when things like that happen, isn't it? Just touching on a couple of the tracks there, you mentioned as well, Losing You. It's a great way to start a record. It's a really menacing start as well to that song. So tell me a bit about that track in particular.
Well, that track appeared in a movie called Blue DeVille. And which was and the video from it actually was brilliant. Really, it was us. We were in Pecos, New Mexico, and it was a fabulous experience because the movie was about this girl who was getting married and she needed to go out and have this bachelorette fling. And her hero was this guy named Eric Fury, who I played Eric Fury. So she was chasing the band. And then she ends up at this one concert and, you know, we sort of have a tryst or whatever you call it. So that was in Burt Reynolds' tour bus, as a matter of fact, which is strange. So that was kind of a big moment for me, you know, because I realized what it took to be in a actual film you know, and so on. And when Losing You Still, you can see it on YouTube, came out from the clip of the movie. It was fantastic. It's really well shot, really well done. And it was a strong opener for the album. Absolutely. No doubt about it. You know, and the recording, I mean, the drums are slamming it. The guitars are ripping. Yep. Again, Roy Thomas Baker, you know, he just knows what he's doing.
Absolutely. Now, obviously, you have been with Rainbow and had success with them and Fandango before that, but having solo success, success in your own name, I mean, you were front and center in the spotlight. It was Jolin Turner that was on the signs. How did that feel, especially with the likes of Endlessly, as you mentioned before? That was a US hit, wasn't it? So how did it feel when it's your name, it's you that's in the spotlight this time?
Yeah, that was the video that ended up on MTV, Endlessly, which... You know, I wasn't really fond of the video at all, but I think it was for its time. What they were trying to imply there, it makes sense. But it's a big responsibility when you've got your name up there, and you're not necessarily, I called it the Jolin Turner Band, but still Jolin Turner was the focus of the whole thing. So I learned what it's like to be responsible, you know, to be the head of a band, just like Blackmore was, because you can always throw it over to the leader. You know, if something went wrong or right, you just throw it over to the leader and you could walk away from it. And that was my fate. But I thought I did a pretty good job of it. I really enjoyed it, you know, and we had great tours with Night Ranger and Pat Benatar and a host of other great bands, you know, and we learned a lot on the road. And we were a super tight band. There's some live recordings that would prove that.
Yeah. Let's move on to record number three then and tell us what that one is.
Let's go with Odyssey, Yngwie Malmsteen. I was contracted by Jim Lewis, a VP Polygram, who actually was a friend of mine before. He sat me down at dinner one night and said, I want you to work with this guitar player. And I wasn't that familiar with Yngwie at the time, you know, maybe a bit from Alcatraz, but that was it. And from Blackmore, of course, because I remember Richie one time holding up a magazine on a flight we were on and said, this guy's trying to be me. I looked at a picture of Yngwie with the same pose and the white boots and all this. And I was like, oh, you know, and he just flipped it off, really. It was quite funny. So that's as much as I knew from Yngwie. But Jim Lewis said to me, look, what you did with Rainbow, I want to do with this guy. He's a great guitar player, but he falls down in the song department. And I feel that a great lead singer, great guitar player, it's always worked in this business, the Glimmer Twins, whether it's, you know, Robert Plant and Jimmy Page or, you know, Richards, Jagger and Richards, it's the combination. So I went out to L.A., for I think it was three or four days to meet with Yngwie, and it was the most wild time ever, because those were the days of sex, drugs, and rock and roll. And he kind of turned around and went, yeah, I really like you. I think we can get on. But by the time I was ready to come back and start the record, he had had a terrible accident, a car accident. So I didn't bail out and go back east or anything. I stayed out in L.A. because the tracks were basically written, just the tracks. Okay. I need to do all melody and all lyrics. Okay. Now here you've got Yngwie in the hospital trying to, it was touch and go for a while, but everybody might know that story by now. And I was kind of overseeing the whole hospital stay. So I was the one that reported to Polygram when Northridge Hospital needed money. I had to get it wire transferred because I was the elder, so to speak. You know, the one responsible out of the group. So I was definitely assisting in that area. But at the same time, it gave me an opportunity to sit down and just write melodies and lyrics to all these great tracks that Yngwie made. And then when he finally got out, that's when we started recording the album. And I think his performances on the album, I think they're amazing to this day, because I don't think he overplayed. A lot of times he overplays on some of these albums, but that time, for whatever reason, I think he played everything in the right place at the right time where it should be. And Odyssey has some really brilliant songs on it. Plus, I did the job that Jim Lewis wanted me to do. We had Heaven Tonight, which was a huge single for him, and Dreamin', which is an amazing ballad. There was finally Rising Force, a song that I figured he needed as a title for the band, which came out great. And these all worked in concert. So that was another big thing, the translating live. So I think, again, another successful record. Would have been good to do another record with Yngwie, but things prevail, you know. And that's the way it goes. Sometimes you go with the flow.
So how difficult is that on a personal level then? Because obviously you're working on music, and at the same time, Yngwie is, as you said, he was in a really, really difficult place. So you're thinking, I've got to make this record, I've got to get this right. But at the same time, it might not even come out, or it might not be the way we want it to be because of what's happening with poor Yngwie.
Well, we didn't even know if it was going to happen, you know, if he was going to make it. Needless to say, I kept on writing. I kept on making sure at least we had that much of the work done, and always praying and hoping that he would come out of it, and we would be able to dive right into the record, you know, slowly but surely. And plus, on top of that, I think what you're really saying is, did I get any help from anyone else? No, because his manager at the time, Andy Truman, was really no help at all. He wanted to put him down in County Hospital because Northridge Hospital was a very elite and expensive hospital. So I went down to County Hospital with Andy one day, and I said, he is not going to stay in this hospital. I looked around, and County Hospital in LA is basically where people go to die. It's just awful. You can sense it. He was in the right place, but it was costing an extremely large amount of money off the advance. And Andy's angle was, we found out later, he was taking these advances. He was pocketing these advances, okay? For example, Yngwie thought he owned his house, owned his Ferraris, all that. No, they were all leased at the time, because Andy just made the perception, the optics, that he owned it. But actually, he was pocketing large amounts of the advance. So I didn't get any help from him. You know, he was the kind of guy that was riding around in a Rolls Royce with a kilo of cocaine on the front seat and a 44 Magnum on top of it. This was crazy. We had to have a 24-hour security in front of Yngwie's house after we got rid of Andy, because he was kind of vengeful. Oh, but it was a hell of a time.
It sounds it. Absolutely wild. And just to touch on a couple of the tracks, you've mentioned Dreaming a couple of times. I've always liked that song. It's the juxtaposition of almost flamenco guitars with the soaring guitar solo and stuff in there as well. So just tell me about how that one came together.
Well, exactly. Beautiful, really. I mean, Yngwie's intro, you know, on the acoustic, and we did it live. I mean, and then You mentioned the solo, which I think is just one of his best solos ever. It's just perfectly placed. It's beautiful. I know he'd probably hate that word, but it's beautiful. And what I can remember is that Yngwie was playing over what I considered a bridge. And I went back to New Jersey to do some vocals with Jim Lewis at the House of Music down in South Jersey. And I said, Jim, this is a vocal bridge. And he said, okay. So what they did was they just brought down the fader from Yngwie's guitar. I sang the vocal bridge and they brought it back up and it worked perfectly. And of course, Yngwie acquiesced to it and said, yeah, it's a great part. It makes sense. And so that's how, I mean, you know, these arrangements, sometimes you don't even know what's going to happen, you know, until you get there. But that was a very important part of the song, I think, that bridge, which just breaks it up, takes you someplace else, and then he comes back in with this soaring lead. Amazing.
Yeah, fabulous stuff. Let's move on to record number four, and I'm actually really pleased that you picked something from this supergroup, as I like to call it.
Yeah, well, you know, it's the most underrated supergroup ever, I think. You know, I had the good fortune to work with Jeff Watson from Night Ranger, Bob Daisley from Ozzy and Everywhere, you know, and Dio, everywhere. And of course, Carmine Appice on drums and Ainsley Dunbar later on. And this particular album, Fire on the Moon, Ainsley was playing with us because Carmine was off doing other things. But I think these are just spectacular albums that we put out. Edel put out a box set, in case people don't know, but there's a trilogy, three CDs in a box set from Edel. And at that point, grunge was coming out, and it kind of just flattened everybody in rock and roll, absolutely flattened us. And we never really got off the ground. In fact, we never played one live show.
Oh, is that true? Wow.
Not even one live show. We were all psyched up, ready to go out, you know, let's go live and everything. And it was just like, gentlemen, excuse me, but there's a new kid in town, and it's called Nirvana and this and that. And we would just looked at each other like, now what? You know, we've got these great albums, great catalog. And it just really sort of hit us in the solar plexus, you know, and took your breath away. It was horrible. And when I listen back to these records, I am just amazed at the musicianship, the writing, the lyrical messages, the content. Bob, especially on the lyrics, and I, we were always being metaphysical. We were being political, geopolitical. You know, we really had messaging, very personal. You take the Lonely, for example, off that record, or you take Do What I Like, you know, very personal stuff. Then you have Fire on the Moon, which is basically the apocalypse.
Yeah.
You know, we're talking about a lot of stuff here politically. Maurer Atoll, when the French were doing all those nuclear experiments, people probably don't even know what Maurer Atoll is, but we were writing it. And the other thing I think, Paul, is the fact that it's a very heavy album.
Yes.
It really is. You know, it's almost metal in a way. You know, it really has that grit and fire. No Religion. Again, speaking out more into spirituality as opposed to organized religion. So we were quite something, in my opinion, and we had high hopes. And I still, to this day, think it's one of the greatest disappointments by all of us that Mother's Army just did not fly the way it was supposed to. Plus, we didn't have real management. We were just kind of floundering around, you know, and all of us had come from big bands and everything. You'd think we'd have a clue. And we were just more concerned with the music than we were with any kind of administration. So, and then again, boom, grunge came in and shot us all down. So we didn't have a chance. But here's the thing. We just found five new demos, which we had remastered.
Oh, wow.
Now. Yeah, and there's a deal going on with it to sort of make an addition to the box set. And there are some really great songs on these five demos that we cleaned up. They're the actual performances, and I mean, they were just live. Everything was live in the studio, everything, even my vocals. I'd be in a booth or what have you. I'd do one take, maybe two, but we always were just, let's keep it live. Let's keep it raw.
And besides, are these five demos from the Ainsley's period or Carmine's period, or a mix?
Yes, it was from Ainsley's period. It was from the Fire on the Moon sessions.
Yes.
Yeah. So just brilliant playing by Ainsley, you know, amazed by all of us.
Yeah.
And these five tracks, we said, you know, they're really great. So we used our own money to just remaster them. We got a fantastic guy out of San Francisco. And boom, he remastered everything, and they sound like very fixed up demos, but they sound great. In fact, I think they're better than most albums because they're real, they're raw, they're vital. You know, they have that feeling to them. So we're waiting to finalize that deal actually right now, but not going to be a big deal or anything. We just want to accredit it, really. We just want it known, you know, so that we have the satisfaction that we completed at least what we had started. So, but Mother's Army, a great disappointment that we never went any further.
Absolutely. And as a Mother's Army fan, I'm looking forward to hearing these five tracks. But you mentioned it yourself, this Fire on the Moon record, it was heavier than the previous ones. Was that a purposeful thing? Did you go into this record thinking we need to do something really hard and rocking on this?
I don't know if it was discussed in that manner, you know, like, hey, we got to get heavy, you know, but it was like, a natural progression for us. We had done a concept album, you know, Planet Earth and just song. We said, look, what are we going to do? Let's rock. We want to just, you know, really hit hard. That was coming. That was kind of the style that was coming out, you know, a little bit more take chances. Although I don't think Mother's Army sounded like anybody. I think Mother's Army sounds unto itself. It's not a comparison between any band out there. Like, you play any track and tell me, who do we sound like? Nobody. We sound like us. It's a unique formula that we had. So it wasn't, you know, verbally like, let's do this or let's do that. It just came out that way. The subject matter needed this type of real raw and rocking kind of background, you know, musically. And Jeff and Bob and Ainsley would come up with these incredible riffs. And the reason why they had to play live is because they broke time a lot. They'd be playing in 4-4, then they go to 3-4, then they 6-8, then they come back to 4-4. And you can't really do that splice and tape. No way. You know, and we were not using digital. We were still using the Studer. So live, it was all live, and an amazing band, really.
And just to ask you a question about how you guys came together, because obviously you mentioned Ainsley, he's worked with everyone from Bowie to Zappa to Journey to Michael Schenker, and you've obviously worked with Richie and Yngwie and so many other people as well, and Bob Daisley, obviously incredible back catalogue, and Night Ranger influences and things like that for Jeff. And so how do you guys come together to create this kind of record? And do you have a long time, or is it a window that you have to fit between other projects?
Yeah, it wasn't really a long time. What we would do is we'd go up to what we called Camp Watson. Jeff lived outside of Frisco, up in Marin Heights, and he had a nice studio up in the attic. Well, it wasn't an attic anymore. It was really finished, beautiful. And we would stay at the house at the camp. You know, he had like a horse and a couple of goats, and, you know, it was a very nice situation, comfortable. And we would write in the living room sometimes, you know, around the coffee table. And then we take it back upstairs and start rehearsing it or making amendments to it and what have you. Very comfortable situation. It wasn't a long time. I mean, maybe we'd spend a month, which isn't much for like 10, 12 songs. Mm-hmm. You know, I mean, to write from finished, you know, right to the finish. No way. Start to finish 12 songs. Bob and Jeff did some work previously. I have to admit that, but they were just skeleton, you know, just bare bones type stuff. So we had to put it all together.
Fantastic stuff. Fascinating as well. And as I said, as a Mother's Army fan, I recommend anyone who hasn't checked out Fire on the Moon, to go back and give that one a listen. Absolutely. Right. Let's move on to number five then. And what's your fifth choice then, Joe?
Well, I had to. My most recent album, Belly of the Beast. It is one of my favorite albums. It took a long time coming to get to this point. What I mean by that is the world situation, my maturity, the situation of the business, everything just came to an apex. Belly of the Beast came out. My association with Peter Tachran had started 5 years before that. And we said, let's make an album together. And then I was on the road and he was on the road. We were both very busy. And I remember only writing one song with him before it all started. And then I finally went up to his studio in Sweden and we wrote two more songs. And then the rest, the pandemic hit, and the rest was all done virtually, you know, just like this on Zoom, what have you, you know, or WhatsApp on the phone. Sending files back and forth. I'm writing the melodies and lyrics. He's refining the music. Yes, no, maybe so, this kind of thing, until we finally got a whole album together. And it is one of my favorites simply because I set out to make a message. I set out to do something more artistic, something different than what I was known for, what I was used to get out of the comfort zone a bit. But more importantly, it's close to my heart because it's a very personal album, personal statements. You can actually see the original oil painting behind me from the cover. And I had seen that 2 years, I think it was 1.5 years before the actual album came out. And I knew that was the cover. A friend of mine painted that. He's a brilliant painter. And I said, that has to be the cover of the album. So while that sat here and I was writing it, it was a great inspiration as well, because I knew I had to stay on track with exactly what I was trying to say. It disturbed some people, which is good, because art should never make you comfortable. Should always wake you and shake you. For example, I forget who it was, whether it was Voltaire or someone who said it should disturb and confuse to a degree. So you'll never forget it. You may love it, you may hate it, but you'll never forget it. And that's what great art is. In other words, Belly of the Beast is not a landscape as far as art goes. It's a real piece. It's a real art piece. Like this is disturbing, this painting. It's disturbing when you really look at it. It gives you all kinds of images in your mind.
It certainly does. Yeah, it certainly does. And something I like to do is read out reviews to people and get their reactions, because the Belly of the Beast had some incredible reviews. I'll just read a couple. Classic Rock's Louder Sound said, Jolin Turner has made a thrilling and intense heavy metal album. Metal Talk said, blown away by this album. It's sheer perfection. And Metal Chaos gave it 10 out of 10, saying this album is the biggest surprise of the year. So how do you feel when all this time has passed and you've done so much in the business and you release a record like this that's so personal, so close to you, and you get that kind of response?
Yeah, it was overwhelming. I have to say, I was on edge, because it was really a big change for me, and I knew it would be. But thank God for my fans, they always stick with me. But as far as the critics, and they can be pretty tough, I was very surprised. And when I started to read these reviews, I was stunned for a while, because I just said, I agree. I believe this is really, in many ways, almost a masterpiece from beginning to end. And I felt that way in my heart and soul. I really felt that way. The work that I put in, that Peter put in, we really felt strong about this record. And to hear that come back at you, in fact, there's one, there was one critic, one journalist who hit it so perfectly on the nose. I actually saved his review, and I wrote a summation of what I felt. He hit every point that I felt about this album exactly. He interpreted every lyric exactly as I meant it, because I've heard some things on YouTube where these guys had no idea what I was talking about, nothing. And that's okay, but it was so far off the mark. To find someone who actually knew what I was trying to say, what I was trying to get across exactly, was just phenomenal to me. But it was also redeeming. It was very redeeming, because I said, okay, you know, Goethe had the great German poet Goethe had a statement to say that one, if there's one person in the world who understands, it makes this earth a garden. And that was my garden, because I said, he gets it. The accolades were great, but this guy just nailed it. So yeah, I'm more than pleased. Obviously, I'm elated, but at the same time, you know, they think you have to make the same album over again, you don't, and you really shouldn't. But at the same time, to make this record over again would be, I think it would lessen its importance, you know. And as an artist, I don't really want to repeat it. You know, because I meant to move on with this record. And now at this stage in my life and in my career, I probably could do anything I want, really. And I just had a conversation with the president of Mascot, and he said, just make the record you want to make. And I said, well, what about this? And what about critics? And what about people slagging me off? And all that. He says, do you really give a shit? And I said, no. I've never heard this from a record company exec. I love the guy. And I said, no, I really don't, because he said, well, make the record you want. Screw everybody. And I said, well, you know, I'm writing a lot of kind of cool AOR songs again. You know, I never stopped that AOR stuff. You know, it's one of my first loves, you know. And he said, well, go that direction. Do what you want. You know, and I said, okay. So I'm still finding out the direction now for the next album, you know, because I have songs written here this way, and I have songs written this way. Songwriter writes.
Yeah.
So I really don't know where I'm going to end up, but wherever I end up, I've got people to support me. And that's my fans. They stick with you thick and thin. They're wonderful. I owe them everything, really.
And do you have a time frame in mind for, you get me excited here talking about new music. Is there a time frame for when we could get to hear any of this?
Well, fingers crossed for 25. Fingers crossed, but we'll see, because this, I'm a new father again.
Yeah.
So I'm spending a lot of time with my son, and it's just my number one priority in life right now. You know, I've already got two grandchildren, but this little guy, he is just a blessing. So it's taking up my time, and I want it to take up my time, because I intend to make a productive and creative human being. You know, and that is the greatest, I think it's better than any song I've ever written, better than any band I've ever been in. You know, this is something really special, because before, for example, with my daughter, I was always on the road. You know, I'd come back and she'd look at me like, are you my daddy? You know, yeah, that's me. You know, so this one I can actually put some time into, and it's just thrilling for me to be able to do that. So I'm hoping 25 I'll get the album out, but there's a lot of distance in the world situation between now and then. So we'll see what happens.
So there you go, Joe Lynn Turner there. I love these My Five Favorite interviews. I've got a few more recorded already and up my sleeve. Some great ones that I know you're going to love, so keep an eye out for those. And don't forget, special bonus episode this week, Joe answering your questions too. That's going to be out on Friday, and it's well worth a listen, I promise you. Also, make sure you check out VRP Rocks Radio. Give it a try. You won't regret it. Some brilliant music from the 60s, 70s, and 80s that you won't have heard on the radio in a long, long time. Link in this podcast description. Also, make sure to subscribe to VRP Rocks on your podcast app so you get all the future episodes released every single Monday. Leave a 5-star review as well if you can do on the podcast app that you use. It makes a huge difference to the discoverability and helps get the word out there as well. And also, check out VRP Rocks on YouTube. It's past 5 million total views now, which is pretty insane. Just search for VRP Rocks on YouTube and hit subscribe, and you'll be able to get all the videos I've done with all these brilliant rock stars from over the years. Right, but that's it for this week's My Five Favorite episode. And don't forget, another one with Joe Lynn Turner coming out this Friday. So until then, take care.
It's NFL draft season, and that means it's time to start thinking about fantasy football. FantasyPoints.com features industry-leading experts and prognosticators using proprietary hand-charted data to help you score more fantasy points. FantasyPoints.com is the place to go for whatever kind of fantasy football you play. Whether you play fantasy football, daily fantasy sports, or do a little bit of everything, Fantasy Points has the meticulously researched content to guide you to victory. And why wait for the fall? Fantasy Points also covers the new spring football league, the UFL. Join the guru, John Hansen, Scott Barrett, Joe Dolan, and other massive names in the fantasy football universe with an exclusive offer. Use code Pantheon for 15% off any Fantasy Points package, including the all-in package, with access to every article, tool, and data nugget that Fantasy Points has to offer. That's FantasyPoints.com and code Pantheon for 15% off at Fantasy Points. FantasyPoints.com, code Pantheon. Score more fantasy points.